Welcome to Hub Headlines. Today's program features the best commentary and analysis published in the Hub for March 20th. Up first is Renzi Natta and Sean Spear writing on Polyev's surging popularity and how his working-class appeal is a key reason why.
Pierre Polyev's recent speech to the Greater Vancouver Board of Trade has received significant attention for its attack on lobbyists and the corporate class in Ottawa. But notwithstanding the attendant commentary, it may not even be the most notable insight from his remarks. In the same breath, Polyev proclaimed that, as Prime Minister, his daily obsession will be about what is good for the working-class people of this country. There's a strong possibility that this vow is more consequential in terms of influencing a Polyev-led government's policy agenda and ultimately reshaping Canadian politics. It holds out the potential for a new multi-ethnic conservative coalition rooted in working-class values that could transform the country's political landscape. One of us will return to its possible political consequences in a subsequent commentary later this week. But any discussion of a working-class conservatism must begin with a clear understanding of who the working class actually is, where they live, what they do, how they came to be in the working class, and what policies will help them flourish in the modern economy. Canada's modern working class is not necessarily who readers might think it is, according to research that we've conducted for the Cardiff Institute. Using a common definition of the working class as the population of workers in jobs that typically don't require post-secondary education, we found that there is a big gap between the common stereotype. White, male, blue-collar workers in the auto sector or some other form of manufacturing employment, and today's working class experience. Here are some facts. For most of recent history, women have actually composed more than half of the working class. Over the last 30 years, manufacturing jobs have constituted a declining share of working-class employment. This is true even among men, for whom manufacturing employment went from a high of 20% of working-class jobs to only 13% today. Among women, manufacturing represents only 6% of working-class jobs. Conversely, jobs in sales and services have grown significantly over the same time period. Today, almost half of the working class is employed in these jobs. Among working-class women, it's more than half. The trades continue to be an important part of working-class employment, but not as much as one might think. It is mostly the helpers and laborers who fall into the working class, as opposed to those with formal training in a skilled trade. There's also a huge difference between men and women in the trades. While 32% of working-class men are in trades-related work or employed as some other kind of transport and equipment operators, only 4% of working-class women are. Immigrants are much more likely to find themselves in the working class than other Canadians. Census data show that the longer an immigrant has been in Canada, the less likely that he or she is a member of the working class. 50% of immigrants who arrived in the previous 5 years found themselves in the working class, whereas only 34%, equivalent to the national average, of immigrants in Canada longer than 35 years did. In short, the common stereotype of Canada's working class no longer holds true. The new working class, as we called it in our paper, is just as likely to be female, much more likely to be working in a sales job or in the service industry, and highly likely to be recently immigrated. These findings have important policy implications for the 6.5 million Canadians in working-class jobs. They constitute more than one-third of Canada's workforce and represent the demographic foundation of a significant multi-ethnic, working-class voter coalition. But any party that seeks their votes must address their real policy needs. On some of these issues, Conservatives have already staked out important territory. Take housing, for example. The transition from a goods-producing economy to a service-providing economy has led to an increasing concentration of the working class in major cities where services are most needed. Our research also predictably shows that the working class earns considerably less than other types of workers. The combination of these two factors makes it exceedingly difficult, if not impossible, for the working class to find affordable housing near where they work. The result is that working-class Canadians face impossible housing choices, including often longer commutes and less time with their families. More efficient public transit will be a key part of the solution to this problem as well. Poilievre's focus, as well as that of his predecessor Andrew Scheer, on housing densification along transit hubs is a good first step in that direction. A working-class agenda must address foreign credential recognition for new immigrants. The time and income lost to immigrants before they can work in jobs that are commensurate with their education is a serious opportunity cost to both them and the Canadian economy. Poilievre's commitment to establishing a 60-day guarantee for recognizing foreign credentials is promising for highly skilled immigrants. However, immigration policy must also recognize that low-skilled foreign workers may compete for the same kinds of jobs as working-class Canadians, which can put downward pressure on wages. This represents an area within immigration policy that could pit a working-class agenda against the interests of businesses that rely on temporary foreign workers, but it is one that will require a response from a future government. A true working-class agenda would ostensibly cut the number of non-permanent residents entering the country and refocus the permanent resident stream so that it's overwhelmingly high-skilled workers. It would also significantly reform the Trudeau government's childcare policy, which fails to provide the flexibility needed by the working class. The current program prioritizes one kind of childcare. Institutionalized daycare, which tends to offer childcare during standard 9 to 5 hours. But our research showed that the working class is more likely to be working unusual hours, including evenings and weekends, and is likely to hold more than one job. A working-class childcare agenda would be built around the needs of these families, which includes flexibility, something that the federal childcare program does not offer. One way to achieve this would be to put the money toward a reformed childcare expense deduction that would flow money directly to parents and leave the decision-making in their hands. Finally, our education system needs a serious revamp. Consider, for instance, our research finding that 53% of those in working-class jobs have post-secondary credentials. This includes 1 in 6 who have a university degree. These numbers suggest a serious misalignment between our education system and the needs of the labor market. While education mostly falls under provincial jurisdiction, the federal government subsidizes the system through the Canada Social Transfer and graduate and postgraduate research through the granting councils. A working-class agenda would aim to rebalance the focus of education policy to better reflect the interests of the 30% or so who consistently don't go on to post-secondary education. These are just a handful of policy areas that need to be fleshed out in a plan focused on the working class. The commonality is that they reflect the interests, needs, and aspirations of today's working class based on how they actually live and work, rather than commonly held misperceptions. These issues therefore represent a good test for Poilievre and the Conservatives and their genuine commitment to a new working-class conservatism. Major policies on housing, immigration, childcare, and education would show that the Conservatives are attuned to changing working-class dynamics and ready to fulfill the vision of a multi-ethnic, working-class coalition for the 21st century.
That was a commentary by Renzé Nata and Sean Speer. Renzé Nata is the Work and Economics Program Director at the nonpartisan think tank CARDIS. Sean Speer is the Hub's editor-at-large. You can find the full text of their article on our website, thehub.ca.
Hi, Hub Podcast listener. Fun fact to share with you. Well, not really. Thanks to growing government intervention into the news media, the next federal election will be covered mostly by journalists whose salaries will be majority funded by one form of public subsidy or another. Yes, you heard me right. Here at The Hub, we think this is bad for journalism and bad for news and information consumers like you. And this is why The Hub will not be availing itself of these government subsidies. But producing high-quality independent news and analysis is expensive and time-consuming. And this is why we are asking you now to become a Hub subscriber for as little as 25 cents a day. Get all kinds of great benefits, including subscriber-only analysis of the economy and politics, podcast content, and so much more, all with the knowledge that your support makes our independent journalism possible. Sign up now at thehub.ca.
Our second essay is by Christopher Kinsinger, writing on the Liberals' online harms law and why it is a full frontal assault on freedom of speech.
While often referred to as the Online Harms Act, the Liberal government's recently introduced Bill C-63, if enacted, would go far beyond regulating harmful content on the Internet. Among many other things, the bill proposes to make three significant amendments to the Criminal Code. The first is to specifically define hatred under the Criminal Code, which currently includes no such definition. This amendment would define hatred as the emotion that involves detestation or vilification, and that is stronger than disdain or dislike, subject to the exception that a statement will not be deemed hateful solely because it discredits, humiliates, hurts, or offends. Meanwhile, the Second Amendment would significantly broaden the current categories of hate crime offenses to capture any offense under any Act of Parliament that is motivated by hatred based on a prohibited ground of discrimination. Currently, the only substantive hate crimes in the Criminal Code consist of prohibitions on willfully promoting or publicly inciting hatred. In theory, this new provision would turn any federal offense, not just those found in the Criminal Code, into a potential hate crime. Those who commit such offenses would potentially be liable for life imprisonment. To say that this is a radical provision would be an understatement. These provisions have already garnered significant criticism from across the political spectrum. However, Bill C-63's proposed amendments to the Criminal Code don't stop there. Perhaps the most significant and problematic amendment would allow individual Canadians to seek peace bonds against others whom they fear will commit a hate crime in the future. Under this provision, provincial court judges would be empowered to call these parties to appear before them to determine whether there are reasonable grounds to fear that the defendant will commit such an offense. When a judge ultimately decides that an individual is reasonably likely to commit a hate crime, their powers are far-reaching. Specifically, Bill C-63 allows judges to issue peace bonds against individuals in such cases for up to 12 months that may require them to abstain from communicating with certain individuals, or from consuming drugs and alcohol, place them under house arrest, or, on the application of the Attorney General, order that they wear an electronic monitoring device such as an ankle bracelet. The inclusion of peace bonds against future hate crimes is arguably Bill C-63's most draconian provision, which says something in and of itself, considering the other provisions of the bill vying for that title. And yet, at the same time, Canadian lawyers and law students, even constitutionalist ones, may be at a loss to articulate precisely how this provision offends some of the most basic tenets of our legal and constitutional order. To this end, a refresher on the rarely cited but crucially applicable legal doctrine of prior restraints is long overdue. In short, a prior restraint is a limitation on expression that doesn't just target the ostensibly harmful effects of that expression but seeks to prevent such expression from taking place at all. This is a departure from the other numerous ways in which our law frequently limits expression. Libel, defamation, sedition, and even the current prohibitions on willfully promoting or publicly inciting hatred are all intended to punish expression after it has occurred. By necessity, prior restraints censor expressive content by turning agents of the state into the licensors of permissible expression. To wit, the evidence that judges will consider when deciding whether to issue the peace bonds envisioned by Bill C-63 will, invariably, include the allegedly hateful content that the individual in question is expected to express. It is by no means unreasonable to fear that certain expressive content will be presumed to cause harm even where such harm has not taken place, much less been proven on a balance of probabilities, the requisite mens rea or guilty act that our law requires to establish that a criminal offense has been committed. The doctrine of prior restraints has seldom been cited by the Supreme Court of Canada. Though the term is largely derived from American legal scholarship and case law, the doctrine itself is rooted in the British law, on which Canada's constitutional order is modeled. Justice Iacobucci recognized as much in his partial dissent in the Supreme Court's 2000 ruling in Little Sister's book and Art Emporium v. Canada, citing the 18th-century English jurist William Blackstone's warning that every freeman has an undoubted right to lay what sentiments he pleases before the public. To forbid this is to destroy the freedom of the press, but if he publishes what is improper, mischievous, or illegal, he must take the consequences of his own temerity. Although Justice Iacobucci did not go so far as Blackstone to conclude that prior restraints are necessarily destructive of freedom of the press or freedom of expression, his reasons ought to serve as an admonishment against the inherent dangers of prior restraints as particularly severe restrictions on speech. Should Bill C-63 become law, the legislation will inevitably be challenged under the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. The doctrine of prior restraints ought to drive the assessment of any peace bond provisions under Section 1 of the Charter, which only allows for limitations on charter rights and freedoms if they can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. It is doubtful that such a profound limitation on a guarantee as important as freedom of expression can survive constitutional scrutiny under this standard.
That was a commentary by Christopher Kinsinger. He is an Ontario lawyer and the national director of the Runnymede Society. That's it for today's edition of Hub Headlines. We hope you enjoyed the program. To receive all our best commentary and analysis each morning by email, subscribe to The Hub for as little as 25 cents a day. You can do that right now at thehub.ca. Hub Headlines is produced by Alicia Rao. Thanks for listening.